This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
The number one challenge here that we see and is, of course, the First Amendment in the United States is a fairly robust protection of rights. And that is a protection of rights both for platforms, which I actually think is very important that platforms have those rights to be able to regulate what kind of content they want on their sites. But it also means that it is a little bit tricky to really address some of the real challenges of where does bad information come from and sort of the influence peddlers who have made a real market economy around it.
That's National Public Radio CEO Catherine Marr talking about how the First Amendment is the number one challenge. How did we get to the point in journalism where journalists consider the First Amendment, including freedom of speech and the press, to be a challenge? And how is that affecting coverage of a big story out of Europe, the attempt to shut down a conservative convention in Brussels? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for faith and mass media. He's author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McMeel Universal Syndicate, and for two decades he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
I'm looking through a Washington Post story on the attempt to shut down this conference, conservative conference in Brussels, and virtually every short paragraph contains some sort of media label: hard-right elites, far-right Euroskeptic, far-right, almost every single paragraph. What in the world do things like far-right or radical right-wing mean in journalism ease?
Well, of course, that depends on who the final editor of the piece is. And I would argue, and in fact, it's exactly what I argued in my Religion and Liberty piece, The Evolving Religion of Journalism, the primary thing is what does the term mean to the paid subscribers or the supporters of a particular media outlet. But before we get in, my brain is so confused on this topic right now. It's been foggy on this whole label thing. You and I, how long have we been talking about what the labels mean? Well, do you have any sense of when that changed?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think you have evolved on this subject. You were far, and when we first started having conversations decades ago, you were far more optimistic about what, journalism and a little more forgiving of these things, but I sense a change in you.
Well, yeah, I think to some degree it was before the language wars invaded the Associated Press style book, which is a really key moment in this whole battle. Maybe we can get back to that. But here's the way I want to start this discussion, because even though this is happening in Europe, and in Europe you don't have the First Amendment per se, but you have United Nations Declaration of Universal Religious Liberty, United Nations Protection of Basic Human Rights. You know, you have all that sort of stuff. But here's the way I want our listeners to think about this. We've been talking for a long time about the fact that the press is not anti-religious. The press is anti-bad religion, and they're very in favor of good religion. In other words, the issue is not that all religion needs to be wiped out or bad. It's whether religious doctrine conflicts with the viewpoint of the speaker, the political party, the publication whatsoever. And so listeners are probably used to hearing us talk about this whole battle of good religion versus bad religion. Really, what we've got here today is good First Amendment versus bad First Amendment. And people whose identity for decades included a strong defense of the First Amendment, they're not so sure anymore. Because how do they defend the First Amendment when it's used for bad people? Now, the Washington Post lead is an absolute classic. A Brussels mayor on Tuesday ordered the shutdown of a gathering of, quote-unquote, national conservatism that was underway in the Belgian capital, giving Europe's hard right elites a further opportunity to rail, wonderful verb, against cancel culture and Brussels overreach. So this is a classic conservatives pounce situation. The story isn't that someone in European culture, in a position of European culture, and maybe even somebody who is controversial because of reasons that readers might want to know about, like connections to the Turkish government, connections to groups that have had tricky labels attached to them in the past. It's not about the action of trying to shut down the conference, which even was later kind of the larger government stepped in and went, well, this guy went too far. What's newsworthy to the Washington Post and its readers is conservatives rail, conservatives pounce. So the actual shutting down of the conference is not that important. What's important is that it gave conservatives grounds to complain. And this is where the next thing you're talking about then, and you kind of hear that in the quote from the National Public Radio leader, you have good censorship and you have bad censorship. Bad censorship is when things you want published aren't published. Good censorship is when dangerous stuff has to be stopped for the good of the American people or for the protection of children or this, that, or the other. Safety is the new trump card with a small t, obviously, the new trump card that gets thrown down in these debates. You can't help but think, especially if you are of a certain religious Christian ilk, that in the background behind all of this is, what is truth? And for journalists, the concept of truth used to be something that emerged from debate in which different people presented verifiable information about why they believe what they believe. And then, unless you could have ironclad evidence showing one side was lying or was inaccurate on the facts or whatever, and you had to report that with great vigor, you end up letting the reader kind of decide for themselves what these facts add up to. To me, the definitive case of this, as much as we might want to jump on something like the Hunter Biden laptop story being banned from big tech in the weeks leading up to a presidential election, etc. To me, the definitive story of our age is the efforts to crush basic open debate about the origins of COVID-19. I think when you consider the impact on the entire world, the impact on freedom of assembly for religious groups, the impact on whether or not newspapers and wire services could even do serious reporting about serious charges being made by serious people. In terms of the need to crush dangerous information for the sake of public safety, that's the definitive story. And even more than the current warfare of American partisan politics, that's the story that I keep hearing in the back of my mind with this whole story with the crushing of the National Conservatism Conference. But when you look at the story in Brussels, what does it take to be radical right wing? What does it mean to be Euroskeptic? What does it mean to be radical right-wing? Did I say that more than once? Because it only happens about 12 times in the first 12 paragraphs of the story. What does all that mean? Well, clearly, the defense of the European Union and the defense of Europe as a vision of a properly evolving, healthy culture, as opposed to, say, Brexit in United Kingdom and England and wanting to get out of the European Union. Clearly, that's here. Immigration then comes up. And I'm old enough to remember when wanting to keep borders secure and oppose extremely high levels of legal immigration, let alone massive amounts of extra legal, to use the safer phrase, immigration. That used to be something that liberals cared about because they wanted to protect labor unions and the rights of blue-collar Americans to have kind of a fair labor market that treated them well. Now, the essence of the battle over the border is that all of a sudden, it's radically right-wing to not want an open border or to not want extremely high levels of immigration. So that entire issue is flipped upside down. And then, of course, constantly, and this looms over the Brussels meeting as well, constantly we have the issue of the sexual revolution and, above all, in the current atmosphere, the defense of transsexual surgeries and medical procedures for children who need this treatment in order to be safe, to feel safe, and not to be driven to suicide. So there you go. There's a whole lot of stuff right there. But if you're on the wrong side of these stories, you are Euroskeptic, right-wing, or, in the words of one Brussels politician, Catholic fundamentalism or Catholic radicalism. At this point, I think our listeners' heads must be spinning, but that's good because they should be spinning after that word storm.
Well, another ad here that I've never seen in print, although I don't frequently read the Washington Post. It's usually behind a paywall, but it's in the headline and it's in the lead in two different variations, far-right elites or hard-right elites. I usually have not seen that noun there with the adjective.
Well, that's really interesting because they're dealing with people here that they really can't just write off as figures that are totally out of bounds. I mean, in the context of Europe, we're talking about people who are getting all these labels pinned on them. When if you were dealing with someone like Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary, if you put a lot of what he stands for in an American context, frankly, he could have been a Democrat from 20 or 30 years ago. And then, of course, you have the person best known for Brexit there. You have a genuinely, in the French context, conservative politician. You have a Roman Catholic cardinal there being labeled, pinned in with all of this. So elites, they put that word there is to say these are not people who are rioting in the streets with torches, but these are still major figures, elites even, in European life. But you know what? Yeah, they're still dangerous. They're still here to spread disinformation and cause debates that don't need to be held. And when Antifa or others decide to make physical threats of violence against them, you need to have the police come in and shut the meetings down for the sake of, and here's the phrase again, public safety. So what do you do?
The story is basically that the mayor of Brussels decided that, as you just said, public safety was at stake. They attempted to shut it down or at least to kind of demonstrate a police presence, but were they successful in the end?
Well, it depends what you mean by that. it was different on different days also. You definitely had a stage, and my friend Rod Dreher, who is a right-wing speaker at this right-wing conference, he's been tweeting out some comments from people, you know, who were prevented from getting in, or when a Roman Catholic cardinal has to find a way to sneak into a building, kind of going through the back door and all that. It's an interesting thing. And then, you know, you have descriptions in the Washington Post piece of the fact that a small group of anti-fascist protesters were outside chanting. The implication there being if anti-fascist chanters are there to shut down a conference, that means they consider the people inside the building to be fascist, not the people who are trying to shut down the meeting inside the building. Did everybody follow that? So I haven't read that much of what's happened today. I did see behind a paywall, I did see a story go by that apparently the Prime Minister of Hungary did get to speak. So I imagine we'll see tons of commentary on that in the news tomorrow. But in journalism terms, let me remind listeners of kind of another place where some of these terms intersect. The best reporting that I saw on the situation yesterday, and the most kind of neutral, even though the word right-wingers is used in the lead, kind of the most information-driven coverage of the story, once again, is published in the Free Press. And the Free Press, of course, was the pivotal story source for the National Public Radio fight and wars. And there's been several interesting developments, including the fact that the 25-year veteran business reporter, NPR stalwart Irby Berliner, has resigned under pressure. He's made it clear under pressure. And then we have a letter out now from concerned staff members at NPR. The letter, you couldn't have written it better for the Babylon Bee if you tried. It's one of these situations where it's very hard to satire. But the key to the letter is we all know that what Berliner said is wrong. And we know that all he was trying to do was attack our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in staffing NPR. And by putting this information out, he has hurt our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Did you follow that? That's kind of a Zen thing. He was wrong to attack our DEI efforts and say that DEI efforts have too much power here at NPR. But at the same time, he raised public wrath that's going to hurt our DEI efforts. And we can't allow that to happen. Kind of an interesting circle going on there, would you say?
So can we even attempt to kind of figure out what is happening to the terms conservative and liberal, the kind of classic binary of politics?
Yeah, well, politics, there you go. Now see, for 20 years at Get Religion, which shows you how old this issue really is, for 20 years at Get Religion, we explicitly attempted to use the term liberal and conservative only in matters of doctrine and church law and church teachings. We were much more interested in religion, after all, than we were in politics. I mean, to some degree, what Get Religion was fighting was the whole idea, the cliche thing we said over and over, politics is real. Politics is the real world. Religion, not so much. Well, we were trying to get people to say that issues of doctrine and church history and religious ritual, etc., are different in different groups. But in those groups, there are accurate ways to describe them. What was the language that CNN put in a story the other day with no comment? It's just made as a statement of fact. That Roman Catholics believe that that the wine and the bread are symbols of Christ's body and blood?
Represent, that they represent Christ's body
was
and blood.
It, yeah, was it represents? Okay, yeah. That's simply factually wrong. Although it is an important story that significant numbers of Roman Catholics no longer believe what the Catholic Church teaches. But there is in Catholicism such a thing as doctrine and even a catechism, and it would help at some point to kind of at least nod in the direction of what the facts are about Roman Catholic doctrine. Well, how did I get off onto that? Oh, back to liberal and conservative. I tried to come up with just the way that you and I have intersected this in recent years in trying to define liberal, because the way I've always worded it is, what should journalists call people in public life who are weak in their defense of free speech, freedom of association, and religious liberty? And obviously, in the Brussels story, we have free speech, freedom of assembly, and some would say religious liberty, since some of the most controversial issues at the conference involved religion, and you have a Roman Catholic cardinal, one of the people speaking there. What do you call those people? Well, you can't, under classic American political science and public square language, you cannot call them liberal. So what do you call them? If you flash back more than a decade to the famous remarks by Bill Keller when he was asked if the New York Times is a liberal newspaper, he insisted that they were being fair, balanced, and accurate in their political coverage, but admitted that in kind of liberal, as in liberal arts, they had become culturally liberal on issues of religion, science, etc., and that this affected gay marriage and a host of other things. So he was waffling on the meaning of the word liberal. I noticed that in his commentary on the Brussels events, Southern Baptist Seminary President Al Mohler went straight to the term leftist. And that might not be leftist to people who are think of themselves on the left. That would be kind of like radical conservative. Leftist kind of means, I guess, pushy liberals, people who want to force certain liberal policies into existence. Well, there I use the word liberal out of context again. Obviously, the other term that we're seeing is progressive. And progressive is used by a lot of people who know that for in red zip code America, the word liberal is not necessarily a positive thing. I've started as the opposite of liberal, as weak on free speech, weak on freedom of assembly, weak on religious liberty. I've started using the word illiberal. Because what we see in Brussels and in a lot of other stories are active attempts to prevent, because of safety, you know, active attempts to prevent free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, religious liberty, etc. So I would say that's illiberal. And whenever I would ask people who wrote in to get religion saying it was wrong to use that term, I would ask, well, what word would you use? And they said, oh, we're just liberals. We're just ordinary liberals. In other words, they would ignore the entire point. Listeners may recall that a year or two ago, I asked a Muslim human rights activist what he was beginning to use in place of liberal and conservative in an age when Muslims are a very important group that must be defended until they show up outside of public school in an audience with Eastern Orthodox Christians, evangelicals, and traditional Catholics to argue in favor of parental rights. At that point, Muslims are not so good anymore. They've become dangerous. They've gone into the bad religion category, the bad First Amendment category. And I asked him, I said, what are you beginning to call these people on the progressive leftist side of the argument? And he went to the French Revolution and said he was beginning to use the word Jacobin, the Jacobin Party. And in America, we don't have people using guillotines to lop heads off, but people are getting their jobs lopped off, shall we say, in some cases, and their free speech rights and their ability to stand up at a podium and speak to an audience without being heckled down. So that's on the liberal side, but let me point out to readers and listeners, similar debates occur about conservatism. And we see debates between, like, take the current debates about abortion strategy. We see debates between libertarian conservatives and cultural conservatives. And then when certain academics put a magnifying glass over that, then you move into right-wing Christian nationalists, national conservatives, etc., and other labels begin to be applied. So this exists, the struggle exists on both sides. And who makes the call? It's the people who write the Associated Press style book and the people who are in charge of coverage at places like the Washington Post, the New York Times, National Public Radio, etc.
Is it too simple to define classic liberals in broad terms as supporters of the First Amendment and modern progressives as opponents of the First Amendment?
Well, I mean, there would be exceptions to that, but I think that you're leaning in the right direction there. What I don't know right now is in public media, like in Associated Press stylebook land, what are you supposed to call the people on the cultural left right now? And I still am waving the white flag on that issue. I do not know what you can get into a regular newspaper to describe this. And you also, you're going to have to try to avoid the labels altogether. The Washington Post story needed a paragraph that said something like, the key issues to those gathered in Brussels for this conference were. And that paragraph needed to include a description of titles of speeches, subgroups that were meeting, and it needed to be factual, and it needed to be something that both people who are in favor of the conference and people who are opposed to the conference could look at that information and say, that's factual information. That's what they say they're there for. And then you can quote progressives or whoever criticizing them for it, and the conservative speakers defending it. But at some point, we need that factual paragraph if we're going to get any sort of trust in the media again.
Does the style book really even matter anymore, since it is, in my opinion, being manipulated in order to also further a narrative? Not to remain objective. Now the point is no longer to remain objective, but to purposefully not be objective.
Oh, it's extremely important. It's more important than what's happening at National Public Radio, the New York Times, or the Washington Post. Although you could say that what's happening at those publications is trickling down into the style book. It matters because the style book is what is shaping the coverage of newspapers all over America, including small towns, small cities, state capitals, even in the red zip codes. The style book, in the end, is going to be what controls a lot of language, like gender-affirming care, birthing persons instead of women, and all kinds of things like that. And that means you're putting editors in ordinary American towns in the Midwest and in Central Texas and East Tennessee and Central Florida and all kinds of places like that. The AP story comes in, and the copy desk has to edit that worldview out of the copy that's running in newspapers in counties that might vote 60 to 70% Republican. Yet day after day in their own local paper, if they're still taking their own local paper, for reasons of lack of trust and a host of other things, that language is affecting all of America. No one should be surprised that that sort of language policing is occurring in New York City or even in the Washington Post, owned by Jeff Bezos and Amazon and that the big tech world. No one should be surprised that this language filters in there. But when it filters into local, town, city, regional cities, state capitals, when it filters down into those newspapers, in many ways, it's even more important. And frequently, of course, what happens is stories on some of these issues don't end up running in those local papers at all because they know they're going to upset readers. And so what you end up with, there's entire areas of life. I mean, like persecution of Christians in Nigeria and issues about religious liberty in Ukraine. And yes, of course, Russia. You have all kinds of things like that that just no longer get in the paper at all because everybody knows they're too controversial to cover. And to me, the classic example of that is right now the symbol in which all these things has been compressed is the battle over what we can say and what we can't say about the origins of COVID-19.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for faith and mass media. He's author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McMeel Universal Syndicate, and for two decades he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.